Hello and welcome back to Rails to Nowhere, where once again, I'm afraid it's just me, Simon. Today, we are following on the story from last episode where I spoke about Victorian suburbia, and we are moving into the 1920s and 1930s and looking at the developments of suburban and urban housing in this period and the way that the city was beginning to change. This is really the point where we're going to begin seeing how the motor car is beginning to influence the geography of the city. So in the last episode, we talked about the emergence of the suburb as a concept and commuting as a experience for the masses. I discussed the forces that shaped the suburban experience in Victorian era London and a couple of other cities, and why the housing that was built in that era developed as it did. And today we'll be looking at how during the 1930s, most growth in London's population is moving further out than it did in the Victorian era. So suburbs such as Walthamstow and Lambeth are becoming stagnant. Indeed, the city of London is beginning to shrink in its population, whilst further afield suburbs such as Surbiton, Harrow, and Wembley are beginning to see a dramatic climb in their population. Through the last episode, we talked about transport and walking and buses and trams, and in this episode, we'll be talking more about the motor car and the motor vehicle and its impact on the geography of the city and how these changing mobility options are changing the sort of buildings that are being built, the way that the city is being laid out, and the urban planning ideas that are coming to the fore during this period. And on that note, we'll be seeing how shifts in the idea of who's responsible for laying out the suburban area are resulting in shifts in design that allow for these new modes of transport to operate and new urban designs to come to the fore. And noticeably, as I discussed towards the end of the last episode, we'll see how there's a notable shift from the Victorian attitude to town planning, where the local authority creates maybe a civic centre or a town centre or railway station with some sort of focal point around that and left the rest to local landowners to manage and develop. How in this period we begin seeing moving through projects like the Kingsway development in London and onwards through more centralised town planning schemes, we see how the local authorities are beginning to become much more involved in more widespread town planning and the layout of more of the cities than just a small area around perhaps the train station or the civic centre of the town. We'll also discuss how, whilst the UK adopts the idea of town planning and planning permission, it never quite adopts the concept of zoning to the same degree as places like the US and Canada do. So one of the first things we need to do is we need to just think about the literature that exists on this topic. I keep coming back to this idea of historiography and literature reviews, but really when you're doing history academically, that's like a really central part of the discussion. And especially when you're doing something like my dissertation, where I have approached the topic in a different angle to a lot of the existing book, it's very important to understand how my arguments are fitting into the overall literature picture. So the topic of suburban growth and city bloat and urban density and all of that is something that's quite heavily discussed in the realm of talking about American and Canadian suburbs. And if you go on YouTube, there's a host of channels such as Not Just Bikes and City Beautiful, which I watch, which talk about this topic a lot in terms of American suburban development. And that's partially because in Europe, suburban sprawl never really went as far as it did in the States and Canada. But to dismiss its existence within Europe and the UK particularly is, I would say, negligent when talking about this conversation. Because whilst it doesn't go to the same degree as in the States, you get a lot of it occurring, especially in Britain, which has a particularly heavy American influence. But it's also important to note the distinction in Britain of the existence of the Greenbelt, which is put in post the Second World War, which really confines in the growth of cities in the UK. As a result, you end up with a lot of the literature being American-oriented. There are various sources down in the bibliography which are sort of American-oriented, and that's what I've had to do, is I've had to take sort of the writing and the talking that's going on about American suburban growth and American suburbia and apply that methodically to UK examples. And say, whilst they're not perfect fits, you can see the same sort of trends. You can see the things we talk about when we talk about suburban sprawl in the States. We can see those being displayed, maybe to a lesser extent, but still being displayed in the UK context. Having said that, there are certain books and literature on the suburban growth in the UK, particularly Michael Law's two papers listed in the show notes, especially The Experience of Suburban Mobility and The Car Indispensable. Also Peter Scott's book, The Making of the Modern British Home, and Ian Carter's book, Railways and Culture in Britain, and a variety of other texts down in the description, which maybe don't necessarily talk in detail always about it. I often refer back to Bagwell and Leith's book, Transport in Britain, because it's a good sort of starting point for a lot of these discussions. And so I've had to take sort of the very developed literature on US car culture and US suburban growth and the slightly less developed but still reasonably there UK literature that exists, and then combine that with my own active looking at things like the Town and Country Planning Acts, town plans produced by places like Harrow Council and a couple of the other local authorities and the LCC. Take them alongside the Abercrombie report, because it's important to understand how it all sort of fits in with the overall picture post-war as well as pre-war, because really it's a kind of continuation that's sort of interrupted by the occurrences of the Second World War, and combine those together to draw my own conclusions and be able to sort of use my case studies to sort of further that discussion and understanding. And hopefully through the rest of this episode, we will together come to have a greater understanding of that literature and how this discussion fits in with that. So towards the end of the last episode, I talked about the Garden City and the book Garden Cities of Tomorrow, and how this began how this signified a shift in thinking about how cities should be designed. Notably, it signals a shift in the sort of sense of the nature that cities should be taking and the sense of the urban form that should be being developed. And following the First World War, this really begins to gain some traction. Whilst Howard's proposals from Garden Cities of Tomorrow were never fully implemented, the Garden City concept is crucial to the image of many interwar developments, which local authorities often referred to using terms such as cottage estates, or in the case of the Metropolitan Railway, they refer to theirs as Metroland. This period is really interesting for urban planning and the history of urban planning. As I say, the idea of who's responsible for laying out a city really begins to shift in favour of centralised government planning agencies, with lots of legislation coming in this period. So we get the Town Planning Act of 1925, which actually a lot of the stuff we're going to be talking about today is proposed under. And we also have the Town and Country Planning Act of 1932. Both of these begin encouraging local authorities to take a greater interest and to set up town plans and to begin developing the idea of planning permission. And these acts really mark the beginning of the legislative road towards the Town and Country Planning Act 1949, which is the legislation under which a lot of British planning rules will continue to be carried out. Indeed, through to today, it basically forms the crux of certainly the English planning legislation that still exists to this day. And so we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but one of the really big things that this does is it begins encouraging the idea of the local authority laying out a road plan and laying out a grid of roads across an area and designating certain areas for certain uses. Now, following the end of World War One, the central government produces the Taylor-Walters report, which is the result of an investigation into what housing should look like going into the post-war period and what housing requirements Britain would have going forward. And they also pass the 1919 Addison Act, which promises the funding of 500,000 new council homes and sets the government's targets for how to build those. This is all part of attempts to meet the desire for new homes in the post-war period, to meet desire for better quality of living, but also to meet the government's pledge to build homes fit for heroes, as they term them. So following the First World War, there's a desire that those who'd gone off and fought in the war should be rewarded with a better place to live, a better country to live in essence. And the idea that we should have fought the war for something, and therefore we should build a Britain that is fit for the heroes that we created in the war. These new acts establish a variety of basic provisions that are expected to be within properties, with modern amenities such as parlours and indoor bathrooms being suggested as being standard. Whilst indoor plumbing is not a new thing per se, and many places did have it in the Victorian era, it's not necessarily standard, and it's not necessarily an idea that that's something that you would have in every home. We also see that the Tudor Walters report basically establish that the terraced, not the terraced, the semi-detached house with a garden at the front and rear would be standardised as the ideal standard home for this era. And it's important to understand the importance of the adoption of the semi-detached house as the standard house in this period. We'll keep coming back to this, but semi-detached houses by default are lower density than terrace houses, and so this really is a beginning of a trend that we see going forward for the reduction in the density of housing development. The early years of the Metropolitan Railway's Metroland, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, fall very neatly into this period. They draw on the idea of the Garden City. They draw on places like Hampstead, which is known as a garden suburb, although it's slightly older, and they are to an extent centrally planned, although they are still constructed by a relatively haphazard mix of private developers. So Metroland is an interesting case study, and we'll come back to Harrow slightly later in the episode talking a bit more about that. So at the same time as these newer, greener versions of urban design are becoming vogue, and with less dense housing ideas becoming popular, so too, as I say, is the idea of state involvement in urban design and urban layout. And the result of this is the cottage estate, as the London County Council would term it, but it's a sort of general style of, well, not rural, but urban housing estates designed to bring the rural or picture of rural living to the city. These embrace semi-detached housing, wider roads, additional green space, gardens at the front and back of houses as sort of central tenets of their design. They also, as council estates, bring this new form of life to working class residents. It's important to note that what suburban life is generally accessible to the middle class throughout this period, and some wealthier working class people, as their wages are rising following World War One, to buy or take on private ownership of some places in these sort of private estates that are growing. But the cottage estates that are built by a variety of councils, including the London County Council, further widen the accessibility of these garden suburbs to a wider range of the working classes. And Scott notes in their text that actually a lot more of the working class are able to access these sort of suburban and semi-rural housing areas than actually traditional historiographies have suggested. And we also see at this time the growth of master plans in the immediate post-war period. We see a flurry of proposals as councils reject the laissez-faire policies of the pre-war period. This is a running theme across the economy. The post-war period is dominated by an adoption of centralised control and a loss of laissez-faire. And as we saw this way back in episode one when we talked about the Railway Act 1921, this is all part of the same sort of trend, the sort of idea that the let it be policies of the pre-war era have failed, and that it is therefore necessary and right for the state to step in and begin taking a greater amount of control. So we see some of the first urban plans drawn up in the 1920s in London, and places such as Harrow begin drawing up master plans enabled by the legislation that's being passed at the time. And this marks a distinct change from the previous pre-war Victorian and Edwardian suburbs such as Walthamstow, which while they'd grown up sort of hodgepodge around existing throughways and byways, places like Harrow begin to grow with a plan and with new roads set out for modern travel demands. So while somewhere like Walthamstow had many twisty roads that were laid out basically based on medieval and earlier road layouts, in Harrow, for example, the 1925
town plan
has whole new roads drawn across fields and with little reference to the throughways that had existed before. And these roads are designated to be wider and straighter and therefore more well adapted to the emerging faster motorized transport that's beginning to take hold in this period. And it's this taking of centralized control and the enablement of new forms of mobility that really begin to allow the motor car to begin to get a foothold during this period. And when we say cities were built for the motor car, this is much more said in relation to American urbanism, but even in Britain, there is a degree to which from the 1930s onwards, we are beginning to build or rebuild and redesign cities with the motor car in mind. And this is really the origin point of that as we begin drawing up these city in places outside of London City and town-wide and in the London area borough-wide plans. So we'll talk a little bit more about advertising in a later episode. I've got a whole thing about it set up for a later episode, but it's critical to understand its role in the growth of suburbia and the development of the designs in the lifestyle that's being sold. So I talked in the last episode about how Garden Cities of Tomorrow criticise Victorian urbanity for being too dense and drab and taking people away from the countryside. And in response to that, there is, of course, an introduction of greenery to urban areas along the lines of the suggestion of Howard, although not as much as he had called for. And if we look at how Metroland and the garden suburbs are being sold in this era, we can see that they're being sold as bringing the rural lifestyle to the city. Indeed, there's a lot of emphasis made on the country lifestyle that you can access, and the Metropolitan Railway produced the Metroland Guide, which talks about country walks and golf courses and all these sort of things that you can do within easy reach of the stations. As we'll discuss slightly later in the series, these don't always come to plan for the people who move in, because a lot of these places end up getting more building work put on them and they end up losing access to a lot of that countryside that was being sold to them. But it's important that we're seeing that this is what's being sold, the access to the countryside, the access to greener space. We also see advertising for motor cars being sold on the idea that that allows you to connect your suburban life to the countryside. And as the countryside gets a little further away, that becomes even more central to that sort of selling, because that's the lifestyle you were sold when you bought your house and you want to access that, and the motor car will enable you to keep that access. Early advertising and promotion of Metroland and the new suburbs rely heavily on these ideas of opening up country life for regular city dwellers. As I say, we've got pamphlets and the Metroland Guide, and there's also an emphasis on the modernity of the houses. So we're seeing this combination of allowing access to a bygone, forgotten rural England, but also with the convenience of modern electronics and mod cons within your house. And that also begins to feed into how the motor car is advertised, because again, that begins to become a modern gadget for the modern home. And we know that these promotions work on people who moved out to these new garden suburbs. As I mentioned, the countryside often got further away as new houses were built, and this leads to an immense of disappointment to new buyers, which we've got oral records of, and people being disappointed that their view of the countryside would be blocked by new developments within just a few years of them buying a place. And as I say, this makes these places an easy breeding ground for the ownership of cars and motorcycles in this period. The car at this time is being sold as both the new toy for men and boys, as well as a way to access the freer countryside oriented lifestyle that people have been sold and then feel that they've been robbed of. And this means that suddenly owning a car becomes established as part of the suburban dream. And in addition to that, there's the idea that it gives you freedom and liberation from the rigmarole of train services and timetables. Buying your own house is sold as a way of liberating yourself from the shackles of being under a landlord. And if you freed yourself with your housing, then you should be freeing yourself in your travel as well. Hello, it's Simon. Sorry for the brief interruption to the show. First of all, a really big thank you for listening. It means a huge amount to me and Ella that so many people enjoy listening to our ramblings about railway and transport history. And we really enjoy that we're able to bring this information and research to so many people. If you'd like to help us to spread the message even further and to help us to make Rails to Nowhere even better, then you can do so over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. You can support us for as little as £2 per month. And in doing so, we send you some thanks, such as early access to all of our episodes, some extra bonus episodes, of which you'll have heard some snippets here on the free feed. And we send you some periodic written updates about how the podcast is progressing. So thank you for listening. Thank you especially to our patrons for supporting the creation of Rails to Nowhere. We couldn't do this without any of you, regardless of whether you're paying us or not. This podcast would be nothing without listeners. It means a huge amount to both of us. Thank you very much. And now I'll let you get back to listening to the show. Additionally, the reduced density of these developments from the housing and the amenity point of view begins to impact walking as a usable mode of transport around these spaces. That's not to say that these spaces begin to become unwalkable and that you can't walk around in them, but they do begin to become less walkable. And that's because of a variety of things. And if we look at how houses are being constructed in these areas and the sort of facilities that are being built with them and the land being occupied with them, we can really begin to see how that is reducing the density of this area. A semi-detached house with a garden at front and rear and a driveway and all these things, it becomes a reduced density space. It becomes further to walk between two houses. And overall, that means you get further and further to walk between your house and the local shop, and that begins to drive the desire for motor vehicle access as well, because people have to travel further from home to their destination. And we can see the beginnings of the development of the facility for car owners to access spaces such as arcades of shops and railway stations in this period, and we'll talk a little bit more about that slightly later. It's important to remember the motor car is not universal at this point. It's not owned by any means by a majority of people living in places like Harrow. But the idea that we're on the cusp of it becoming the next big mode of transport is really driving the designs. And we can see that it is driving these designs because we can see the changes in road shape, road design, provision of parking, provision of access spaces. And it's also important to note the impact of the motor car on communal and private purposes in this period. For example, the post office and municipal organisations are beginning to buy motor vehicles. We begin seeing the motorisation of rubbish collection, as well as things like buses and postal vehicles. And this means that we're seeing the need for commercial motor vehicles to access wider and wider amounts of the city. So we're seeing developments like paved streets, wider streets, the sort of street where you can pass a municipal rubbish lorry on the road. And we're also seeing greater communication capacity for the motor car within boroughs. The borough plans are providing roads which allow for better use of the motor vehicle. And as I discussed back in our episode on the motor car, we're seeing the development of cross-borough and cross-town plans with the LCC and other London local authorities coordinating on the creation of routes like the principal A roads, which means you now have a straight, fast, uninterrupted road which crosses out of different borough boundaries and different town boundaries with relation to the other, providing a smooth, easy way to drive between various different places, further encouraging the ownership, usage, and proliferation of the motor vehicle in this period. And with the arrival of the motor car, and to an extent the motor bus also encourages this as well, but especially the arrival of the motor car, we begin to see an unlocking of these developments from railway stations. So we begin seeing developments growing up alongside new trunk roads, developing away further away from railway stations than people could reasonably be expected to walk, but without the provision of public bus services. This is something that the London Passenger Transport Board is very aware of in this period, especially for locations such as Ilford and Greenford. They're very aware that these areas are growing up away from the provision of public transport. There's a review that I found in the records into the provision of rail services on the LNER route out to Chingford and the provision of bus services connecting into that to try and think about how it would serve the new suburban area at the Chingford Farm estate and proposals potentially to introduce a tube service to better provide that. So the London Passenger Transport Board is very aware of the impact that these new areas that are not necessarily dependent on the underground in the same way that places like Morden and Cockfosters and Edgware were in the previous decades. So instead of concentrating alongside railways like we saw in the previous episode with Walthamstow, we are instead seeing a concentration of commercial and manufacturing and employment centres along the new A roads and the new trunk routes that are being constructed throughout London. And so this is driving the decoupling of urban and suburban development from its previous dependence on rail expansion. And so this is really demonstrating that whilst the motor car is not yet a universally owned item, it is beginning to really shape how the city is developing. So if we just take a look at a couple of case studies to think about practically how this is all impacting the actual growth of London, we're going to take a little bit of a look at Harrow on the Hill and the London County Council's Chingford Farm Estate. Like Walthamstow last time, this is because these are the case studies that I picked for my dissertation. They're not the only case studies you could use. They're not all-encompassing and they're not necessarily embodying everything that we're talking about. But they're good pictures that sort of demonstrate what's going on. So all of what we've seen is resulting in shifts in how the urban landscape is developing over this period, and especially in relation to the motor vehicle and domestic life. And we can see in these case studies some of the key challenges to reducing motor car dependency today, where we're talking about spaces that actually were built or rebuilt for the usage of motor cars for travel. And so as a result, the design of the areas have a lot of aspects which are good for driving around, but not necessarily so good for walking around, or make it harder or slower to walk around, or less good for serving public transport. So when looking at areas like this, we can see how the new municipal controls are impacting the layout and design of the city and the areas. In both Chingford and Harrow, we can see that there are roads which are wider, providing more space as for parking, as well as for vehicles to move around. They are straighter, they are designed for higher speeds. We can see junctions with better sight lines for motor vehicles, with shallower curves, with roundabouts being introduced, which are designed for improving traffic flow and really only come around with the motor car's emergence. In the Harrow plan, for example, we can see roads listed as being 60 feet wide, which makes them four-lane roads, allowing either large flow of traffic or two clear traffic lanes and a lane of parking on either side. This is clearly showing a thinking about there being a possibility of increased traffic going forward, and this allows for faster speeds and allows for improved interconnection between Harrow and neighbouring council areas. You can see the integration of the North Circular Road beginning to happen across North London during this period. And again, this is meaning that the motor car is becoming a viable way of travelling around the city and travelling between areas, especially orbitally around London. This is a particular point because orbital travel has always been poorly served by the railways and public transport more generally in London. So the underground and the mainline railways are radial. They're coming into the central area. They're coming into central stations. If you want to travel between two outer London boroughs by the underground, you generally have to travel into zones one or maybe two and then change and then come back out. And even on the bus network, radial travel is the focus of services, or traveling into local town centres, and it's still quite difficult to travel between local town centres on buses. This is still a problem to this day. London Transport, or Transport for London, have got the super loop being proposed to be brought in over the next few years to try and address some of these changes. And there's many debates about whether that is or isn't the solution to the problems, but it just highlights that travel between outer London boroughs has always and still remains quite a difficult thing to do by public transport. And this is really where we begin to see the motor car come into its own. So while we may not be seeing ownership of motor cars being especially high in the period we're talking about right now, we are seeing the expectation of increased ownership being prominent in government and local council thinking. We're future-proofing these spaces for the anticipated emergence of motor vehicles. And that's really an important fact that we need to sort of remember, is that throughout this period, it's the anticipated arrival of the motor car that's having a major impact on how the city is growing. We can also see in the private sphere, so away from what the council is doing, but in terms of the private sphere, we can see features such as garages and drives beginning to emerge on properties. So practically, this is facilitating the storage of motor cars and their care, and also motorbikes. But it's also signalling that the idea of this being part of the new suburban dream is happening. So these garages, again, they're not necessarily expected to have a car in them from the moment the house is bought, but it signals that this is part of the aspiration. This is what people are looking for. The builders are putting garages on. You can also see that a lot of these garages are being put in as retrospective planning permissions. So there is a degree to which they are being put in at the last minute when people are suddenly thinking, actually, this is what we want to have on the properties. I also, when examining the council records for Harrow in the 1930s, we can see a lot of planning permission requests for a number of petrol stations. So we're clearly seeing that there is demand for fuel for motor vehicles, even in these suburban areas. So even though not everyone's owning a motor vehicle already, we're getting demand enough for petrol stations to be built. In Chingford, we're seeing the same sort of design standards as we're seeing in Harrow, with wider streets, driveways and garages being built on houses. And all of this is pushing the properties further apart. So we've got a wider street, we've got a front garden, we've got a garage, we've got a driveway. That's pushing the properties further apart. It's resulting in a lower density of housing versus the terrace house. And this has two effects. One, it means that we're fitting less people into the same size piece of land. This is especially pronounced in comparison to Victorian urban design, where you would see maybe tenement blocks, but also multiple occupancy within one terraced house, whereas we're now moving towards the era of single family homes, of the idea that actually you don't necessarily live with your grandparents or your parents, and you don't necessarily have one family living in one house for multiple generations. You actually have a point where two people move out when they get married. So you just have a mother, a father, and the children, which is reducing the density of living, which means that you need more land to house the same number of people. This means that you have further to travel travel between locations, potentially, if we're thinking that services are provided to the same number of people. And so if we're having to provide schools and hospitals and shops and entertainment facilities and parks and things to the same number of people but spread over a greater area, then the distances between home and destination A and destination B becomes greater, it becomes less walkable, and that encourages, certainly later post-war, people to begin looking at ways to transport themselves greater distances independently, because it adds time to bus journeys and that slows things down. And if you have to change routes, that becomes more complex and tiresome. And so that in itself will encourage car ownership and car usage further on into the 20th century. And so finally, having established that suburbia was changing significantly and that the motor car was a driving force in how that was occurring, as was the changing expectations for housing and public service provision, the question that we now have to ask that really drives the rest of the conversation going through this series is, was London Transport aware of these changes and the impacts that they were having on London, and was it actually trying to overcome those changes and meet the challenges that those presented for providing London's public transport services? And the answer to this question is very much a yes. London Transport were aware that London was changing. They were clearly very aware of the exact nature of how that change was manifesting itself. If you look at the various records from London Transport at the time, it's clear that they were aware that the general trend for population change in this period and the period leading up to 1933 was for population growth in the outer areas, with a reducing population being identified in the central area. Obviously, the government keeps fairly good records of where population is. We have the census every 10 years, and there's also efforts to observe where buildings are occurring and where housing developments are happening. For example, through the 1930s, London Transport makes reference to sending out various groups of people to research where housing developments are being proposed, where they're being built, to monitor them. They're not just looking at the paper records, they're not just taking in reports from the councils, they're actually sending people out onto the streets to look at these new developments, to understand the nature of them, where they're growing up, how fast they're growing up. They're maintaining their own set of maps within the London Transport headquarters at 55 Broadway. So they are annotating the ordnance survey maps to show where these new developments are actually appearing and how those are growing and spreading. And this is then all feeding into decision-making processes about how to respond to these changes, how to meet the travel needs of these changes. They're carrying out traffic surveys in these areas to see how people are moving around, how many people are moving, how many people are going to train stations, and how many are going to shops, and all of these sort of factors. And this is all feeding into the decision-making process. It's all feeding into how do London Transport adapt their transport network throughout this period to meet the changing needs of London's population. And that's not to say that they get things right or they do things perfectly all the time. They don't. They are an organisation run by people, therefore they don't always make the perfect or the best decision. But it is clear that London Transport is aware of the changes that are occurring in London at this time. It is conscious of the impact that's having on its network. We will talk as part of the overall conversation in later episodes about how London Transport is acutely aware of the growing motor car and the fact that this is presenting a risk to its monopoly on a large chunk of London's travel market. And so regardless of whether London Transport actually achieves its aims of meeting London's travel needs in this period, which by and large, I would argue that it does. There are some gaps in the provision, and we'll talk more about those in later episodes. But regardless of whether it actually meets London's travel needs in this period, it is very definitely aware of the changing travel needs that London has at this time, and it is trying to meet those needs. So that's really where we end off with this episode. We now have a firm understanding of where London Transport's origins lie from the first couple of episodes of this series. We now have a clear understanding of how suburbia and commuting have developed over the period leading up to the creation of the London Passenger Transport Board, as well as an understanding of how it would continue to develop through the 1930s up to 1939. And in future episodes, we're going to be taking a look at the actions that the London Passenger Transport Board was taking to try and meet those changing demands and to meet the needs of the growing city. In the next episode, we're going to be looking at the New Works Programme, which is the effort to expand and unify the underground. And in subsequent episodes, we're going to be looking at similar efforts on the buses and efforts to adapt new technologies to be used by London's public transport system. At this point, however, I'm afraid we're going to be taking a small 3-week break between episodes. So rather than it be 2 weeks to the next episode, it's going to be 3 weeks till our episode on the New Works Programme. This is just because the production schedule has slipped ever so slightly. It's partially due to Ella being away, partially due to me just being disorganised because of my ADHD and being exceedingly busy. So we're going to have 3 weeks now until our next episode, and then we'll be back for the New Works Programme. Subsequent to that, we'll be talking about buses and then onwards towards looking at London Transport and technological innovation. So sort of a follow-on from our previous series on British Rail technology. So thank you for listening. My name has been Simon. This has been Rails to Nowhere. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do feel free to leave us a like or a review on your podcast platform. This really helps us to spread the word. And if you liked the show enough to support us with making it, then you can do so over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere. Otherwise, you can connect with us over on social media at twitter.com/RailsToNowhere, assuming we're still on there and it isn't paid for by the time you are listening to this, or over at Instagram as well, over at instagram.com/RailsToNowhere. Otherwise, thank you for listening and have a good day. You've been listening to Rails to Nowhere. This episode was presented by me, Simon Sarsen Co. Rails to Nowhere is produced by me and Eleanor Ashton, with research for these episodes being carried out by myself, with contributions from Ella. Rails to Nowhere is brought to you by our fantastic patrons over at patreon.com/RailsToNowhere, where you can support the creation of this podcast for as little as £2 per month. And an extra special thank you to those who have supported us at our £10 archivist tier. Thank you very much, Valkyrie Lemons, for your support. Without the support of our patrons, this podcast would not be possible. Until the next time, thank you for listening and have a good day.